You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. My name is Mwangi Kimenyi. I'm a senior fellow and director of the Africa Growth Initiative here at Brookings. And on behalf of the Africa Growth Initiative and the Brookings Institution, I would like to welcome you to this very important event. We do have some seats in front, so if you could, if you don't have a seat, there is availability in front. I would also like to recognize, I know from the registration we have a number of ambassadors from various countries, and at some point maybe we would like to recognize who is here, and so that if you have a comment, we would like to note that. So thank you very much. The Africa Growth Initiative focuses on issues of economic growth. How can we achieve high and sustained economic growth in Africa? As we know, that's the most important way, or the most assured way, to raise the standard of living of the people in Africa. But we also know that to achieve economic growth, institutions are core, are very important. And we know that democratic elections are very important for building these institutions. And Senegal, as we know, for a long time, we have known Senegal as the best example of democratic governance. And now we are faced with issues, and we don't know what's likely to happen in the future, and so it's an important time to discuss about the elections coming in Senegal. Now, increasingly, we are often baffled by African leaders. And we keep asking questions, is someone going to run again? Is Museveni going to run again? Or we ask the question, what's going to happen when he is out of office? What's going to happen when Mugabe is out of office? Or the president of Angola? And the question, it occurred to me, maybe we spend a lot of time asking the wrong questions. Probably we should be asking, what will happen if this president continues ruling this country? What happens to these institutions? What happens to the country? And we deal with that. And it reminds me of a story, by the way, a true story, of a tourist who visited Africa and saw a Maasai boy with a lot of goats, about 100 goats. And he asked the boy, how many goats would you take home if one of them went missing, and what would you tell your parents? And the boy asked this person, where do you come from? And the tourist asked, why do you ask that? Because you ask very stupid questions. If one goat is missing, I'm not going home without it. Probably we should be asking this president, when we ask them whether they are going home, we probably they should be saying, that's a stupid question. I'm not going anywhere until probably I am done another way of exit. So I think we have a problem in Africa in terms of these constitutions, our institutions, and Senegal being a very important country in West Africa, we need to see what our law is, how do we understand the institutions. And today we have a very good panel. And all the panelists here are very good, well experienced on Africa, and they will be introduced. But I thought that I would like to bring in someone from outside Africa to moderate and to ask those questions, but they will not be stupid questions. But he will be asking what's going on, and we'll see what type of answers. Whitney Snyderman is actually someone with very good experience in Africa. He has been with the State Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and he has been working with the businesses. He has been dealt with the issues of trade and so on. But most important, one of the most important things in his career is that he is also associated with Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings Institution. He's serving as our advisor on several policy issues. So, Whitney, take off.
Great. Thank you, Wongi. Let me extend a warm welcome to all of you, and thank you for braving the rain and the cold to come out for what I think will be a most important panel. Before we get going, let me just observe some protocols here, and I think AGI is probably the only place in town where we ask you to keep your cell phone on because we want you to tweet. Or you're welcome to tweet if you would like to, and that hashtag is hashtag AGI Senegal. We've received a number of questions over the last week on via Twitter that we will feed into the discussion today. But please put your phone on silence, and we will try to make this as interactive as possible. Now, just let me briefly introduce the panel. As Mwangi said, I think we've assembled an outstanding group to really get into the issue of Senegal, its elections, its economy, and what the next several weeks are likely to portend for that country's future. To my left is Vera Sangwe, who is currently the country director for Senegal, Cape Verde, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, and Mauritania at the World Bank. She, too, is one of our own. She's a non-resident senior fellow with the African Growth Initiative here at Brookings and also a lead economist at the World Bank. To Vera's left is Chris Fermunio, who is with the National Democratic Institute, where he's currently a senior associate and regional director for Central and West Africa. And Chris has vast experience in democracy, elections, in Africa. And to Chris's left is Dr. Mamadou Diouf, who's the Leitner Family Professor of African Studies and the director of the Institute for African Studies at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. And Professor Diouf brings a most impressive biography, and I urge you to look at some of his writings because it's hard to find anybody who's given more attention and thought to Senegal than Professor Diouf. So the format is I will ask some questions for the next 30 minutes or so, and then we'll turn it over to you to hear your questions. And hopefully by the end of this, we will really have had a good discussion about Senegal and where it seems to be going. But Chris, let me quickly turn to you and ask you to set the scene for us about these elections. You know, what are the major issues at play? Is this just about President Watt, or are there issues that the opposition candidates are putting forward, and place these elections in the context of the emergence of democracy in Africa as well?
Well, thank you very much, Whitney, for those very kind words of introduction, and Mwangi and the Africa Growth Initiative for putting together this very important panel discussion on Senegal, which is one of the more important countries on the African continent. This is the 10th presidential election for Senegal since independence, and I would say this is the most important election that Senegal is known in its over 60 years of existence. I would also respond to your specific question by highlighting three factors which I think provide a proper context within which to evaluate what's currently going on in Senegal. First of all, I would say that these elections really threaten to get at the exceptionalism of Senegal because as many of you in this room know, and for those who've written extensively on Senegal, on Africa and spoken on Africa, we traditionally had that one paragraph where you said all of sub-Saharan Africa was either ruled by the military or under one-party regimes, except for Senegal, Botswana, and Mauritius. These elections are threatening to deprive us of that opportunity because even beginning in the 1990s, with a third wave of democratization, as other countries came along, Benin, Mali, Zambia, and even South Africa, after the collapse of apartheid in South Africa, we still took delight in being able to cite Senegal as a country that stood out because it had never been subjected to military rule, and it had practiced political pluralism for many, many, many years. I think these elections are really a blow to that level of exceptionalism. Secondly, I would say that these elections, in a very strange way, pit Abdoulaye Diouf against Abdoulaye Diouf. In the sense that many of us in the 80s and in the 80s and even in the 90s revered this intellectual, this lawyer, eloquent lawyer, this visionary leader, opposition leader who talked so much about democracy. He talked so much about African Renaissance. When he got into power, he was one of the leaders of NEPAD and talked about governance issues with some level of commitment. And we all thought that was the beginning of a new wave of leadership on the African continent. And here we are, having to pit this visionary leader versus the President Abdoulaye Diouf that we currently...
Wad.
Sorry, Abdoulaye Wad. It's Abdul Diouf and Abdoulaye Wad. With President Abdoulaye Wad, who now seems to have all of Senegal around his person, and who is coming across as not even respecting the things that he went out and lectured Gbagbo about in Cote d'Ivoire or lectured Gaddafi about in Libya. And the low point for me in all of this was when last month, around January 27th, in response to an interview by a journalist about the controversy regarding the Constitution, President Wad said to the journalist, I'm also a lawyer, talking about himself, I know this Constitution more than anyone else. Nobody can talk to me about this Constitution because I wrote it all by myself and I wrote it all alone. It's a quote in an FP, an AP story. And I think that for me is very telling of the person that President Wad has become today compared to the Wad that many of us knew and respected in the 80s and in the 90s. And the last thing I would say on that point is that this is happening at a particularly bad time for West Africa, because despite all of the efforts of ECOWAS, and I would say amongst the sub-regional organizations on the African continent, ECOWAS has been one of the strongest in terms of setting up standards for democratic governance and credible elections, that despite all of these efforts by ECOWAS, this is particularly a bad time for West Africa in terms of political stability and in terms of credible elections. Senegal itself has got issues in the southern part of the country, in the Casamance. It's a low-intensity conflict that isn't going anywhere. And on the contrary, in the last few weeks, we've seen skirmishes that have led to the death of Senegalese soldiers. Incidentally, when Wad campaigned for president in 2000, this was one of his campaign promises. He said he would resolve the issue in the Casamance in the first 100 days in office. That was before the 2000 elections. So Senegal has got the issue in the Casamance. To the southern border, you've got Guinea-Bissau, which is a basket case. And many people have written about Guinea-Bissau as a narco state, and it's got its own issues. To further south, southeast, it's Guinea-Conakry, which is in the process of still grappling with its own transition from military rule to civilian democratic rule, and still has legislative elections pending. And to the west, we have a country which, up until a few months ago, looked very stable, looked like a functioning democracy, and today is engulfed in a major crisis with the Tuaregs in the north, and I'm referring to Mali. And then to the north, there's Mauritania, which is also another case. So in the past, Senegal has been viewed as the anchor in the sub-region. And today, unfortunately, we're in a situation where the metal in the anchor is kind of melting before our own eyes.
Great, Chris. Thank you. Farah, let me ask you, you know, we're in an election cycle here in the United States, and one thing that characterizes our last several election cycles has been the refrain, it's the economy, stupid. How much are economic issues playing in this election? Are people, you know, we see a strong youth movement. Are they being driven by unemployment? Or, again, is it just Wad and the concern of losing the exceptionalism that Senegal has developed?
Thank you. Before I start, I want to thank you, Whitney, and thank AGI for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think, like most of us on the panel, we all have a special place, or have always had a special place in our hearts for Senegal. So what's going on here, we would have really loved to sit here and be talking about a different Senegal and not the one that we're talking about today. But coming back to your question, I think there are three things, and you're right, it's the economy. And what we see on the streets, I think, of Senegal today is a population, as we all know, which had one of the highest literacy rates, which has a middle class that was rising. Senegal, one of the exceptional issues about Senegal is it's not a resource-rich state. Senegal is a pretty diversified state. Senegal had been able to lift up a number of its people from poverty. But then you get to a sort of what we call an equilibrium trap. Senegal could not get out of this growth cycle. And then what you have is the 2008 crisis. The 2008 crisis comes and sort of puts a stop to what was otherwise a nice economic growing country. Senegal was growing higher than the average African country before the 2008 crisis at about 5.5%. After the 2008 financial and world crisis, it fell to about 3% and then down to 1%. And those 2 years, I think, brought even more a lot of the desperation of the youth in Senegal. In the last decade, we went from having about 5,000 students in, 25,000 students in universities to today, 71,000 students. So Senegal is graduating that many students from university. Yeah. Senegal is graduating an even bigger number from high schools. These students are all looking for jobs. Now so we have two issues there. One is when you come out of the university, most of them in the literary areas did not have jobs because they haven't been working with the labor markets to meet the appropriate labor demands. Having said this, again, like I said, Senegal is a pretty diversified economy, so there should be, by definition, ways of making sure that this new and young generation has access and entry into the labor market. But very strong labor market rigidities, which had not been tackled in the last decade, and which existed, but Senegal continued to grow because there was an overall world economic boom, are now becoming more and more evident and need to be dealt with. For example, rigidities in hiring and firing, links between the labor market and the education system, issues of health services and labor codes and labor laws. So I think the government has to deal with that to make sure that this population of 70,000, 80,000 does have a job. And I think that's what you begin to see is you have an educated class that is asking. Mm. So that's one part of the economic issue. The second part of the economic issue, I think, is inclusion. Mm. And I think, again, Chris mentioned it. It's one in every two Senegalese lives below the poverty line. So 50% today of the Senegalese live below the poverty line. And I think as one of the things that a lot of the electoral candidates are talking about is agriculture. Mm. A lot of the Senegalese, 70% of the Senegalese, actually are involved in either agriculture or fisheries. Those are the two big agriculture staples of Senegal. What has happened over time is the regulatory environment again. When you have an international boom, a lot of these things can be masked because anyway there is high demand. But the minute when the world demand drops, then you have to be able to compete, you have to be able to produce, you have to be able to have the appropriate regulatory framework. Today in Senegal, the framework around fisheries is not good enough. So you have a lot of poachers, you have a lot of illegal fishing rights. So the population that made its mainstay off of fishing is not being able to do that anymore. The second thing is agriculture. Senegal today still depends on rain-fed agriculture for most of its agriculture. And as we know and we are seeing, climate change is affecting that. So what you need is new regulation around irrigation policy. You need new regulation around ownership rights, especially for women who are the ones involved in agriculture, and you don't have that. So again, I think Senegal did really well coming up into the 2000s on the macroeconomic front. They've been very stable. They've had good debt sustainability, good fiscal deficit, and during the crisis actually put in place good expenditure policies, huge investment policies to manage the crisis and actually stayed up. But I think what is happening, as actually is happening in, we see in some of the countries in Europe, Greece and Portugal, is that structural level. Hmm. They have not yet made the big reforms at the structural level that need to take them to the next level. So I think what we see today in Senegal, masked behind a lot of the political discussion, is a cry out for better reforms in the economy, structural reforms, governance reforms in the regulatory system, and then more inclusion of the population so that many more people benefit from the growth that we continue to talk about because they're going to be growing at 4.5%, which I think in Europe or the U.S. is a number that anybody would like to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Professor Diouf, let me turn to you and ask your analysis of the movement running up to these elections and whether or not ethnicity, religious factors, regional loyalties are are playing a factor in motivating some of the opposition candidates? Or, again, is it something different? And the role of the Islamic Brotherhood and the Muslim Brotherhood in Senegal, how are these cultural factors playing out?
I would like first to thank the Brookings Institute for inviting me, in particular the Africa group, to this panel to discuss elections in Senegal. I would like to begin to say first that I think one of the problems we have when we are trying to understand what is happening in Senegal is that we have been mystified by the so-called Senegalese exceptionalism. For one reason is that we are always comparing the political situation in Senegal with the other African countries. And if you do that, you over-exaggerate the kind of democratic system which was established in the country since independence. But if you locate it within the Senegalese trajectory, you see much better the flaws of the system. And in particular, you understand better what has happened with Wade and why his style of government, his way of dealing with the different actors of a society is having such a negative effect. Because Wade is not an anomaly, contrary to sometimes what we say. He's a product of the Senegalese system. And he has to be understood within the system. And it is precisely what is actually signaling his kind of skills, manipulating the society and making sure that he can always benefit, is why he's so unstable in his political approach, is why his style of government is a kind of systematic attack on the institutions. Is why he can say, I wrote this constitution. He did not, actually. So I can interpret it. But what he does is to revise it every time he needs it, which show indicate one thing which Senegal share with all African countries, in particular Francophone countries, is that the constitution is an instrument of power. It's not an instrument to protect the right of the citizens. It's clear. You know, and if you compare with the American constitution, you see it clearly. The Senegalese new constitution voted in 2001 was revised 15 times. But he failed the 16th time, and he tried to revise it to enable himself to put his son to replace him. So this is the first problem. We have to go back and separate facts and fiction. And, you know, the Senegalese free regime have been very good at selling themselves, at using the so-called exceptionalism to be able to be on, you know, center stage and get resources, resources which enable the system to work for so many years. But the problem with Wade's regime and with his party in particular, it's not an administrative party compared to the Socialist Party, or compared to the PDCI, all these parties which were created by bureaucrats who knew how the administration functioned. Wade is coming from a world much more of liberal professions. And he doesn't know, basically, how a state works. That's why he's destabilizing the system and using institutional destabilization as an instrument. And the result is the collapse of the whole system, which will hold only in reference to him. He is the only reference. For these last 12 years, what we have is a president. We don't have a government. You can count the number of prime ministers. You can count the number of ministers losing their position and coming back. But you can count also, and it's where ethnicity becomes important, has an effect. If you don't have institution, people have to hold on something, and they hold on their religious leader or their ethnic leader or their regional leader or their city leader, the mayor. So it has an effect, a complete disorganization of the system, but a disorganization of a system which favored a kind of strong presidentialism, a kind of individual and personal power. The result is the transformation of such an individual power into a family affair. This is also the effect of the way in which the system is functioning. And paradoxically, one of the most important victories of the Senegalese, who had fought between 1983 to 2000 to put together a system which will allow democratic and transparent election. And what participated very actively in this battle, it's precisely those gains which has been completely destroyed by WAD after 2000. And the impossibility of building a solid system is today what we are paying. And one of the most interesting aspects is in relation to Muslim clerics. During these about 20 years between 1980 and 2000, they were pushed in the margin of the public space. And they were contained. They were unable to give the so-called legal, the prescription to vote for a specific candidate. WAD not only recycled them back using, you know, just finances, you know, is what we call, mercenary support. And it's why you have so many parties in Senegal. It's why you have so many associations in Senegal. Because an association allows you, even if you are not a good singer, when Youssou N'Dour became a candidate, all Senegalese artists had access to the president. Mm-hmm. He needed artists against Youssou N'Dour, so he paid. And WAD has been paying his way through. And the clerics are back now redoing Digel. And the interesting thing is the same people who did Digel for Diouf are back, but it's creating a kind of explosion within such group. And this is very dangerous for the stability of Senegal. I was in Senegal when WAD went to visit his marabout in Touba. And it was fascinating for me to hear a president on TV say, "I'm sorry, I was elected by my people, the Mourids. I will do more for them. You, the other citizen, you can wait. I will deal with my people first." You know, and this is a president who is claiming to be a lawyer and who has no sense of citizenship, no sense of equality. And this is today the problem now. You know, within a social context, which is a very, very difficult social context, this is a country where 70% of the population is between 0 and 25. They are unemployed. The educational system is not functioning. And even the kind of gain which were made, when I left the university in 2001, were around 25,000 students, and I was teaching 2,000 students. Now we are back to a horrible situation where it's impossible to teach. So the generational crisis is what is fueling the violence today. You have a kind of generational blockage, and we historians have shown that probably the most powerful driver of African history is generational change. And if you have a blockage, you have a crisis. And if you have a crisis, you will have child soldiers. And this could happen to Senegal today.
Right. Prof, that's fascinating. Let me just pick up on some of your themes and ask you, Chris. You know, the man versus the institutions. I think you've raised a very important point. As we all know, democracy is more than an election. You know, elections are the result, theoretically, of institutions that work and that are responsive to changing public opinion and currents. Chris, talk to us about the institutions in Senegal. We saw last summer when President Wade tried to change the constitution, as the prof referred to get his son as his successor, but also to lower the percentage that he needed from 50% to 25%, and he wasn't successful. We saw most recently, however, it seemed he was successful in keeping out, you know, candidates such as Youssou N'Dour. In an environment where the generation maybe is driving the change, as Professor referred to, are the institutions in Senegal strong enough, supple enough, to really mediate that change and lead us to a new era, or do you sense that they're not, and we will see the more dire outcome that the prof alluded to?
Yeah, let me just say, in agreeing with Prof, that in some ways Senegal is fortunate in the sense that you know, about 96% of the country is Muslim, so you don't have these sectarian tensions that we see in countries such as Nigeria and or Sudan before Southern Sudan became independent, and also that Senghor was a Catholic, and for the Senegalese it didn't mean anything. They continued to respect him, and he governed very well. But I would also admit that in the last 12 years, we've seen a weakening of Senegalese institutions, probably because of its heritage, because Dakar was the center of Francophone West Africa, that right at independence, Senegal had a semblance of institutions that functioned. But in the last 12 years, we've really seen that a number of those institutions have been further weakened. For example, the judiciary. I know that the Constitutional Court would still have to make pronouncements on the electoral process. So you don't want to take on them right away, giving them the benefit of the doubt. But it's known that Senegalese are very critical about the credentials of people sitting on the court, and that it's a common belief that the judiciary was weakened about 18 months ago when President Wade stacked the current Constitutional Court with people that were seen as very close to him. There have been some criticism that in making the decision on the candidacies that were filed, that the court was not explicit in laying out the reasons why certain candidacies were rejected. My sense is that as this process continues to unfold, we will continue to hear criticisms about the judiciary and the Constitutional Court in particular. When you look at the legislative branch of government, it's also been weakened, because traditionally in Senegal, the leadership of the National Assembly was elected for the duration of the legislature. And when you have a Speaker of the Parliament who is elected for a five-year term, with that leadership, they would feel emboldened or empowered to be able to do the things that we expect of legislative branches of government in functioning democracies: exercise oversight, legislate, represent citizen interest. But when Macky Sall was the Speaker of the National Assembly and had a falling out with President Wade, then Wade got the backbenchers of the PDS, of his party, to revolt against Macky Sall and to amend the rules of the National Assembly, the rules of procedure, to the point where the Speaker of the National Assembly in Senegal is now elected on an annual basis. And that has weakened that institution, because whoever becomes the Speaker is not going to feel empowered enough to speak on behalf of that institution and to be able to exercise the appropriate oversight. So I am very concerned that as we go into the elections with institutions that don't give confidence to the Senegalese people, there could be a stronger desire to resort to other means than to seek recourse with the institutions. And when you talk about the efforts to amend the constitution, I would say that many Senegalese would say that effort was stopped not by the legislative branch of government, but by the streets. And we have seen in other countries, in Nigeria when Obasanjo tried to amend the constitution, we saw that in Zambia when Chiluba tried to amend the constitution, or in Malawi, that the parliaments of those countries stood up and said no to the presidents from their own political parties. But the 16 amendments that Prof referred to did pass without anybody raising a finger. And if the streets of Senegal hadn't come out last summer to say no to the 16th Amendment, I'm sure the Constitution would have been amended despite the presence of legislators in that body.
Fascinating, fascinating. Farah, let me ask you, wearing your World Bank hat and representing a donor, how the donor community might be looking at these elections and what these elections might import in terms of relations with key institutions such as yours, such as the U.S., such as the EU, such as the AU. Obviously, foreign assistance is still quite important to Senegal. Foreign investment, I think, is even more important. Diaspora remittances are quite critical. What's the impact on these relationships of what's happening now in Senegal?
Thank you. I think speaking first for the World Bank, of course, and then I think it would extend to the donor community, it's four things in on the economic front. Again, the first is the elections are happening in a difficult economic environment. So what we want to do is make sure that we can manage the overall vulnerability of the economy and ensure that post-elections, Senegal comes out still resilient, which means, by definition, that what we are trying to do is make sure that the coffers of the state are protected. As we know, and it's true across the world, during elections, usually expenditures go up a little bit more than normal. In this case, it means that the financing gap for Senegal, or how much money they will need next year to continue financing their development plans, may be reduced because they finance the elections. And what we're trying to do then is make sure that we can safeguard some of the important programs. For example, as we all know, in terms of investment, one of the main criteria for Senegal is energy. Mm. And Senegal, in the last 2 years, has had extensive energy problems, and we're trying to, as a donor community, collectively help to bring back some stability to energy. Just to give you an example, in Senegal, it takes about 40 days to get electricity if you're a business, whereas in Ghana, it takes 4 days. So, and then when you have electricity, you have quite a number of shortages. And I think what the international community has been trying to do is twofold, going back to this managing vulnerability and making sure that expenditures are well managed. It's bringing the private sector to come in, because with the private sector you get slightly better governance, but you also get additional financing, because in the current environment, the second thing is looking for extra financing. Most of the donor community and international organizations like ours that provide concessional financing to countries like Senegal do not have as much resources to provide to Senegal. So what we're trying to do collectively is improve the business environment so that we can at least be able to convince private sector to go in. Senegal in 2009 was one of the top performers in doing business, which is an index that the World Bank puts out annually on good business countries. But I think, again, and this is, I think, a question of sort of persistence in reform, Senegal, and this is maybe similar with the constitution, you come out with a good constitution, but then you don't stay the course. So while they were a good performer in 2009 and they moved up almost 12 points on the doing business index, have since gone back down. And today they are number 26, to put it in the context of the subcontinent, in the doing business index, where you have countries like Ghana, Cape Verde, Mauritius, and Botswana and South Africa in the top five. And so what we're trying to do is, again, work with them to make sure that they can continue to pursue this, one, to bring in additional investment, and secondly, to make sure that they can keep the their fiscal sustainability on track. The third thing that we're trying to do is, again, because it's all linked to the economics of this, is in times of elections, you squeeze out expenditures to the most vulnerable in the society. And as you all know, and it was discussed earlier, in the Sahel region, we're now having a drought, but we also have externally and worldwide rising food prices again, which means that the vulnerable are becoming even more vulnerable and are being hit from two fronts. If you add that to the security issues in the Sahel, we really have a potential boiling problem there. So I think a lot of the international community is also focused on this vulnerable part of the population to make sure that during this period, at least we continue to provide basic services for health care to the mothers and children and good education to the kids. So that's the third thing that we're doing. The final thing is governance. And I think in some sense it embodies everything that we're discussing here, is particularly in the run-up to elections, institutions are weakened. And I think there is a discussion in the international community, and we talk a lot about stress-testing banks. I think that elections stress-test development institutions and stress-test countries generally across all institutions. And I think it's only until after you have had a successful election that you can actually say that a lot of your institutions, including your finances, work well. And one of the things that we're trying to do is, for example, safeguard procurement laws in Senegal, working very quickly. And Senegal, I think, in the run-up to the elections, had one of the best procurement laws in the sub-region and actually across the world, and we were actually trying to take it over to East Asia. But in the last 18 months, and even recently in the last three months, we have been getting amendments, like amendments to the Constitution. We've been getting amendments to the procurement law, which are, again, re-weakening the law. When you think that a lot of the procurement is important because that's how you get in the energy, that's how the private sector comes in to invest, that's how you buy the school books, then you realize that the whole system around that is also weakened. So I think we're working a lot on the governance of the state to make sure that we can at least preserve and protect some of the what we'll call wins or acquis in French, and make sure that post the elections we have something to work with, and that at the new framework that whoever government comes in place can protect, one, managing the resilience again, like I said, addressing some of the initial structural change issues, which is improving the investment climate, improving the business environment. I think unlike Cote d'Ivoire, you know, where if we went in quickly, which is what most of the international organizations are doing, you go in and you reform the cocoa sector, you reform the rubber sector, then, you know, the economy starts growing. In Senegal, there's no one sector that you can go in and just cut because, like I said, it's a pretty diversified economy. So you really need to be working across the investment infrastructure, providing the hard infrastructure and providing the environment for reform. So it's slightly more difficult. But I think with a little bit more initiative, they have more to win on the other side because then you open a lot more broader space in the economy. The third one is protecting the poor and making sure that they post-elections, we still have, I think, a cushion of gains from what we have been doing, especially during this period of food crisis and drought in the Sahel. And finally, the governance environment. So those are the four things we're working on.
Prof, before we turn it open to the audience, let me ask you sort of one of the big questions. Certainly one of the major stories coming from the continent over the last 18 months has been the Arab Spring, change in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. But sub-Saharan Africa has been pretty immune from that so far. But where do you see Senegal in relationship to the dynamics in the Maghreb in the north? And could we see that happening? Is Senegal a candidate for experiencing the same kind of change that we've seen in northern Africa?
Again, I think that we have to really understand what is happening in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, looking at the logic, which is the logic of these societies. But I would like to say that we are reading the Arab Spring as something which is very different from what is going on in Africa. We began before the Arab Spring. We had 10 years, 20 years before them. And they have to learn from us how system could be blocked.
Right.
And the Tunisian and the Egyptian are learning that. We have learned it. You take Ivory Coast, you take Senegal, you take Mauritania. We have gone through that. And the interesting aspect today, our main challenge is, why are we failing? Because this is the end of this 20 years we called the democratic transition years. And they ended up in very, very complicated and very tragic situation. Guinea-Bissau is one case. Guinea-Conakry is another case. Liberia is a case, etc., etc. So the problem is precisely what to do today. Of course, as I was saying earlier, you know, for a historian trying to understand what is happening is sometimes quite interesting. As I say, it seems that the dynamics of our societies is based on generational conflict. And the possibility to move from adolescence to adulthood. And it's a male problem. It's not a female problem. And it's why it becomes violent. The kind of maturity, the maturity of an adolescent and the passage to adulthood is played in the public space.
Well, let me just put a pause there. I think it's a good time.
I will pass.
Let me open it to the floor here. I'd ask you to identify yourself, and please keep it to a question, a short question. I think there are a number of you who want to ask things. We have an excellent panel, and why don't I start right over there with you, Julius, where the microphones are coming around.
My name is Julius Abo. I'm an Africa Research Fellow at the Brookings. My question relates to the intervention of Professor Mamoudou. Two short questions. The first one has to do with, in the 1960s, we experienced that import substitution industrialization did not work in Africa, and the argument traditionally was that it was never really tried, failed transition. You mentioned that in the 1990s, there was a wave of democratic transitions that happened in sub-Saharan Africa, and so Africa has actually preceded North Africa in terms of springs. But what we witness is that it was not really a transition. It actually failed. Is Africa really endemic to failed transitions? Then the second question has to do with your mentioning. African states, as we all know, are mostly kleptocratic governments, characterized by excessive discretionary powers in the hands of the executive. And so I would wonder whether the background of the leader really matters, whether it comes from civil society like Diouf or is trained in the colonial schools like Paul Biya of Cameroon. I wonder whether the background really matters when you have an exceptionally discretionary kleptocratic system of governance. Thank you.
Prof, do you want to take a quick response to that, and then we'll collect some other questions?
Very quickly, I think one of the problems we are dealing with and it's different circumstances. In the 60s, the idea which was shared by Africans and their supporters was that the state has to play the key economic role. One, second, the economy should be nationalized because it was the oversight of sovereignty. Third, very strong governments were necessary for integration. And I think what you call the democratic transition failed, but Africans paid a very heavy price fighting for the opening of their system. So it did not work, is why we have to really investigate why. Because we don't really know. We say a lot of things, but we don't really know. We need to do the job in order precisely to come up with solution. You know, when you read, you know, all this literature about Africa and how to fix it, one of the most interesting aspects is, one, Africans are not part of a discussion. It's always people, in Washington in particular, who are going to tell them what to do. But second thing which is important is everybody has a solution. But what is the problem, nobody knows. Because it's easy to have to have solution. And the third thing is the tension between actually the what international institutions and donors are saying. I'm always amazed when I read Senegal is doing well. And sometimes I'm saying it's probably because, again, people are mystified by what using the liberal vocabulary. But one of the most hostile regime against Senegalese entrepreneur is the liberal regime. Mm. He has been going after whoever was successful, from Youssou N'Dour to Baratal, from Baratal to the head of Sonatel. So about the background, I think the problem is simple. If Africans are not coming up with their own solution, they will always have problems. We are waiting people to fix us instead of thinking about how to fix ourselves. So we'll not do it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me take a couple of questions here. I'll start over here.
Hi, my name is Chris Sinman. I work with Booz Allen Hamilton. I wrote my dissertation, conducted a lot of field work in Senegal on democratization, public opinion toward democratization. So this is a really interesting panel for me to hear, and I wanted to thank you. I have two quick questions. One is a follow-up to what you said, Prof, about the transition from adolescence to adulthood being a problem for young men. Do you think that that could transition into radicalism? Because I think another part of Senegalese exceptionalism is that AQIM has not infiltrated the country, even though it's partly in the Sahel. So that's one thing I worry about, particularly for young Muslim men. My question for the panel is, how do you see the elections playing out? Wad's going to run. My worry there is that, you know, I know Senegalese are ready for him to go, but I'm worried because the opposition are so split. You have really good candidates with Macky Sall and Idrissa Seck and all of these people. So what do you think is going to happen? Thank you.
Great. Let me take this question over here, sir.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Mamadou Samba from Senegal. Share the same first name as Dr. Joshi. So,
makes it easy.
Great name, by the way. So, my question is, Dr. Kimenyi here recently wrote about an article he titled, Should the Right of the Africa's Diaspora to Vote Come with a Responsibility to Pay Taxes? And he said that, and I quote him, considering that members of the diaspora have higher income than the median income of their home countries, giving them the right to vote without requiring tax payments is a luxury that African countries cannot afford. Rights must come with responsibilities. My question is, yes, right perhaps should come with responsibilities, but should they come at a price to pay taxes? And I think that that's an important question to ask, which deserves some attention.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. I saw Professor Zartman in the back has a question.
William Zartman from SAIT. What if he wins? Can he lose? What if he loses?
And one more. Ola.
Thank you very much. Professor Diouf, I asked a question. And I have two observations and then a question after that. Number one, I think it's if you look across African countries, two things are very clear. Number one, most of these countries, if not all, where the borders were drawn by other people. And I haven't seen in a lot of countries where the system of government, in particular, governance was a decision of people sitting down and saying, this is how we want to be governed. So what we have, as you mentioned, is people are given a constitution to work with, and then they keep tinkering with it, and amending it. But if this amendment do not recognize the native or traditional system of government that is transparent, that is stable, that people have been used to for, I don't know how many years, I don't know how we're going to have stable governments in this system. Everybody usually quotes Botswana as a success. But of course, the Botswanas were lucky that the British did not destroy their native system of government. And today what you have is that you have a house of parliament, a third house, that is made up of the chiefs who control their autonomous tribal regions. The Ghanaians have been successful also in incorporating them into governance. So the question is, how do we want to solve this problem? How do we want to ensure that we can have stable governance without bringing in these things? Thank you.
Okay, let me turn to the panel here and just add one more question from Twitter, and we might start here. The question came, besides public condemnation, are there tools that the U.S. government can use to urge President Wad to cede power, and is there the political will for doing so? So we've had a couple of themes come up about the issue of male radicalism leading to further integration of AQIM from the Northern Agra. You know, what about the different candidates? Do they really matter here? Will they be able to express themselves? The issue of paying taxes came up, and that's quite important. Professor Zartman, always provocative. And this last question about the integration between traditional and modern governance. But Chris, why don't you start with the issue of the U.S.? I'm not asking you to speak for the U.S., but in your experience of working on the continent, working for NDI, working with the U.S., are they likely to use influence to urge one kind of outcome or another?
Well, I'm reminded of the saying that if the only tool you have is a hammer, then you're tempted to see every problem as a nail, because that's the only thing you have in your toolkit. But when I look at the Senegalese context today, and I look at the whole range of possible stakeholders that could engage, or possible interlocutors, there are not really many left. ECOWAS right now is going through a leadership crisis. They're trying to sort out how to get their house in order and whether the next chairman of the commission should be from Benin or Burkina Faso. I think the heads of states of ECOWAS are meeting in Cotonou this week to try to sort that out. There isn't an individual in that mist that President Wad will be glad to listen to and not lecture to. The AU, you all saw what happened in Addis Ababa at the last AU conference, General Assembly of Heads of States. They couldn't get their act together. They're going to spend the next 6 months trying to find a new chairman for the African Union. I doubt that the African Union is going to want to take a strong stance on Senegal and make its voice heard. Amongst partners for Senegal, the French have a lot of influence and a lot of connections. They, too, are now very involved in their own elections coming up in April. And there are a lot of pictures that have shown some of the people who could speak out in good company with Wad. And I wonder whether the French are going to pay attention and whether, even if they spoke out, that Wad would be willing to listen. It's remarkable to see how the personality of Wad has evolved in the past few months. Going all the way from him trying to get his son into a meeting of the G8 and a photo opportunity so the son could have a photo opportunity with President Barack Obama, and that caused quite a stir in Senegal, to him now saying a few days ago, this is a Senegalese problem, I have no lessons from Paris or from Washington. But I still believe that in spite of all of that, the U.S. has some influence with Wad, because the Senegalese, I think their natural inclination has always been to have good relationships with the West. I think that it may be too late in the process to get him to redraw his candidacy. I don't think anybody thinks that he's not going to persist and stay on the ballot through February 26th. except he was struck by some extraordinary wave of lightning or enlightenment to then create conditions that would allow for the Senegalese to step back, to have a conversations amongst themselves, and to come out with a comprehensive formula that would allow him to withdraw his candidacy and maybe for the election date to be shifted back so his party could have an opportunity to nominate someone. That would be the most elegant solution that one could see at this point. Or else, I think the pressure is going to have to stay on through election day. And if I could just pick up on what Christine and Professor Zadman said, both of them, I think that for once, the opposition is not as fragmented as it would seem, and that what we're living through right now in Senegal could be comparable to what happened in 2000. Some people look at the electoral trends in 2000 and say, what won in 2000, not because the PDS, his political party, was strong, but because the PS was weakened. And in 2000, you had people like Mustafa Nyas and Djibouka, who had been strong members of the PS, whose split camps with President Diouf at the time, and endorsed Watt's candidacy as part of the CAP venture. What we're seeing now is a lot of heavyweights from the PDS, his first three prime ministers, Nyas, Idrissa Seck, and Macky Sall, all have now joined the opposition camp and are running against Watt. So I would say the PDS is weaker now than it was in 2000, and that may be a trend to track, even though Watt would say that in 2007 he won on the first round, but we know the circumstances under which those elections were conducted. We also know that in 2009, during the municipal elections, the local elections, that the opposition won big, and including in the city of Dakar and a lot of the other municipalities in big cities. So the electoral trends, if you just look at it from a statistical standpoint, don't really seem to go in his favor. Now, in terms of Professor Zatman's hypotheticals, if we had a crystal ball, we probably would make the calls. But, you know, I think there's still a silver lining. The optimist in me, and when you work on democratization in Africa, you have to stay an optimist. But the optimist in me would say, in all of this, there could be a silver lining in this story if we all wake up on February 27th and the story coming out of Dakar is that President Watt didn't get the majority that he expected. He didn't win, or he didn't win on the first round. And then the narrative would change, because then we would all be talking about how the citizens of Senegal stood their ground, came out in their numbers, citizen participation was high, people deployed domestic observers, they monitored the process, they reported on the process, and they made it impossible for an incumbent president who had modified the constitution multiple times to be able to win an election. So I think we still have 2 weeks to track this closely, and it will be difficult to make a call until, I was going to say the fat lady is sang, until the jury is in.
Yeah, great, thank you. Vera, let me ask you, not so much about the male issue, I think that's important, but the gender issue more broadly. You know, we've seen in a number of countries like Rwanda where they're 50% or more of parliament is women. Where are women in this? And to go to this question, you know, is it this notion of male radicalism that the prof raised, you know, is that something to be concerned with here? And does that create an opening for the political environment becoming radicalized in Senegal?
Thank you. I think maybe I should start by saying we need, in general, more women presidents on the continent. We have a few, and they're Nobel laureates. So.
Right.
I don't know, the gender issue, I think, actually, as a matter of fact, we have two women running for president, so in the grand scheme of things, there is a woman's there are women's voices on the general podium, as is evident. Their names were not mentioned during this discussion, so I don't think they are among the top category. But I think the gender issue is more important at the beginning of the process, and the question then, at least for us in institutions like mine, or most of ours, is access of women at the primary and education school level. And there, Senegal is not doing that well. and the numbers can drop off as you go towards secondary school and as you go towards high school. Senegal, in terms of meeting the MDG goals on maternal mortality, is doing very badly. Mm. And again, so, you know, and you have, as in some parts of the Sahel, issues of female genital mutilation and religious rights and requirements that cause extra problems. So I think in the overall dialogue, because when you talk about, say, for example, I spoke about agriculture, 70% of agriculture is done by women. If they do not have rights to land, if they do not have access to finance, then by definition, they are not let into the discussion. Then when you get towards the parliament, and we know and we've seen cases, and the World Bank just put out a report in the WDR on gender, where we know that if women are not involved in the policy formulation process. In India, for example, women had to walk and young girls had to walk 2 hours to get water, which was the main reason why they could not go to school. Once you began to get more Indian women in the legislature, that was the first thing they changed, and the number of women girl enrollment went up really high. When the rest of the men were making the laws, they were giving more money to the school teacher who was a man to make sure that the women come to school. So there is clearly, I think, evidence that if you have women in decision-making roles and policy-making roles, the access of other women and better policy for gender improves. So in that sense, I think that Senegal, like most of the subcontinent, and actually everywhere, because we have debates, I think, in the EU that have just passed a law asking for 50% representation in the EU Parliament. So this is not, and this is maybe one place where Africa is doing much better, because maybe we came to the discussion much later and are benefiting from the experience of other continents. In the US, it took decades, centuries, for women to have universal suffrage. I think in countries like Senegal, we are now, the question is not can women vote, it's can the diaspora vote. So I think we have to look at it in two stages, how far we've come, how quickly on the continent, and then secondly, how much more there is to go because of some of the cultural and entrenched issues. So for Senegal in particular, I one of the big issues is just good education and the quality of education. At this point, I think just providing that to the 71,000 that are at the university level or the 100,000 that are getting into primary school is pretty important. They are now, I think, and Senegal has this difficulty with education because you have the two systems of sort of the French education, or should I call it the Western-style education, and then the Muslim Arabic schooling. And in some sense, the issue is how can we streamline that so that girls have access on both sides, and that the quality of education on both sides at the end of the day is, can you get a job? And so how can you do that so that you can provide gender with the right job? So that is, I think, a global
and
problem.
And who are the two women running, and what are their background? Are you familiar with them?
One is, her name is Duma Jeng Jahate. Mm-hmm. Actually, she was my classmate. She is only known for one thing. She is the most successful Senegalese fashion designer.
Okay.
But she's a little bit illiterate.
Yeah.
The second one is a professor of law.
Professor.
Well, we have a singer as a man running. So if you have a singer as a man running, let me interject.
Yeah.
And you have a fashion designer as a woman.
No, you are absolutely right. But one of the interesting, one of the interesting aspect is that she decided to run probably a month ago. And actually, the criticism leveled against Youssou N'Dour, he's illiterate, was not leveled against her, which is the interesting aspect of this whole discussion. But I agree with you. One of the probably most important successes of President Wade was to recruit women in the political system and to recruit youth, and we have to recognize that. He did it compared to the Socialist Party, and it has renewed the political class in Senegal. But again, the problem is you never know what is behind what he does. Mm. 2 months ago, in the context of the election, he decided with, you know, what he called parité, equal representation of men and women in the parliament. You know, just going from nowhere, without organization, without discussion with women organization, without taking into account a lot of things people have been doing. So The tension is usually, you know, a tension between what he says and the way he uses it. Women have been always playing a key role in Senegalese politics. Senegalese women began actually voting before French women in the colonial context. But the problem is how women are represented in political parties, how they are represented in representative bodies, and also how they are used. And this is the interesting aspect. I say that as a historian. Mm. Sometimes they are not agents. Right. They are resources for politicians. Right. Right. You know, what happened in 2000, why the Socialist Party lost at a point, is was the violence during the election.
Yeah,
and women who used to be voters were forced, in some cases, to stay home. And this is what we are experiencing again today. I'm just saying what is happening.
Right.
The presence of young males in the public space, in meetings, is why Wad was unable to have his meeting in Rufisque yesterday.
Right.
Because they exercise violence and they force women to withdraw, which is very bad, but it's part of it's really part of the system. But
Prof, let me ask you, I just want to pick up on Professor Zartman's question and ask you to give us, sort of looking forward, your crystal ball, you know, if Wad wins or if he loses.
Yeah, besides what I was going to talk about, one is too late to speak out. The international community had many opportunities these last 2 years to speak out and try to fix it. Even the Senegalese themselves has organized what they called the Assize, and Wad was invited to participate, saying this constitution is not working. We are in a deadlock. Can we all sit and try to find solution? It's too late. Mm. Third, I think the U.S., the French, they have such a formalistic approach of what is happening that they are not able to understand what is really at stake. What is really at stake is not only what. It's the whole Senegalese political class. They are too old. Okay? All of them, from the opposition to...
Yeah.
And again, I'm going back to my obsession generation. You know, this is the oldest political class of West Africa, and I can tell you why. What made Senegalese successful created such a tragedy. In the other countries, you had civil war, military coups, etc. So it changed. In Senegal, it's the same. People who were 18, student leaders in the 60s are now. And why is it so important? You can denounce the same lack of democracy in the opposition than with Wad party. Mm. You have the same people who are leading these parties for 20 years. So this is also a problem. So it's the system which is now the problem. And what is interesting is youth movement are exactly the groups who are addressing all those problems and fiction, in particular by saying they are much more individualistic. Right. You have a cultural shift which is not translated politically. Yeah, and this is what is creating problems. So the solution is simple. I'm not sure that the elections will take place. One, so what people have to do today, why, you know, if Wad is going to win, he says that he's sure he will have, and I'm giving you the number, 53% he will win. It is already cooked.
Mm.
It's obvious.
Inside track.
No, this is the first. The second thing, everybody knows that if Wad wins, the first thing he will do is try to put his son. The Senegalese don't want that. You have all the ingredients for a crisis. Today, the only solution is to postpone the elections and make sure that he's not running and organize election in June.
Let me take some. We've got a couple more questions. Right? Over there. Yeah. I see you. Just hold on a second. Hold on a second. Wait, behind you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Anne. I'm a student at SAIS across the street. About this youth movement, I have a question. I was in Senegal in June, right before the protests about the constitutional amendment went on, and all of my friends who are not highly political, but I think are a pretty good representation of what the average youth is in Senegal, were so excited. They were like, this is it. We're going to go out in the streets. We're going to show what? He can't do this. We're proud Senegalese men a lot, and we're going to show him he can't do this with us. And they were incredibly proud because they did. I think what happened on the streets was critical in why he withdrew. But then I was there again in January, and there's still a lot of critical youth, but a lot of my friends had also completely changed their view. They're like, all right, he made a mistake, but he apologized. He's still a live view. He's still, like, guiding our country, and I would rather trust him than any of these opposition candidates. So I'd be interested in your point of view, and first of all, what Wad is doing so right and the opposition is doing so wrong that they can't keep youth excited for only 6 months about a change that they might be able to achieve? And also, if you think there's a role for youth after the election, no matter who wins, or if it's more something that's easy to mobilize in case you need people on the streets, but then you kind of forget about it again because they're not that important in the political system.
Okay, Steve. Right here. Yeah, right here.
Take 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Thank you. Steve Landy, Manchester Trade. A light comment and then a serious comment. The one thing I've never understood with my U.S. aid funds is why they don't set up a secession fund. It would save a lot of money. President goes through what he's supposed to go through, accepts his term limits, leaves, and so on, gets a job at AGCI, gets a job at Georgetown, funded by USAID. Such a simple solution. May not develop the systems people talk about.
Professor Wright, everybody does have a solution, don't they?
Okay. Now, my more serious comment is that I heard a comment about ECOWAS, and the one thing I do not understand, I'm really looking a lot at the World Bank as far as I could see, there's no way that whatever the quote donor, which may not always be the best word because Africa pays a big price for the donor, so it's more of a partnership. But anyway, but the donor community, you can't work in every single country. So you have ECOWAS, which really got a good start, has a common external tariff, has a common currency, has a lot of things in place and so on. I just say the UMOA has the common external tariff. But in any case, it really has moved well and it exists. So whether it's UMOA or whether it's ECOWAS, can't we work more through these institutions in terms of democracy building, relying on African peer pressure, which had some very notable success recently and so on, to push our way? Not one comment was made, other than the quick comment on ECOWAS, which was appreciated, on a role of the regional groups to play, and yet I don't see how we can do it on an individual country basis. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Osita, do you have a question?
Thank you very much. First of all, let me appreciate the professor for throwing light into what...
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Osita Obu, a visiting fellow with the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings. There's a lot of myth about what happens in Africa, and I think the professor himself has tried to put a light to it. There is myth about what's happening in Botswana, there is myth about Mauritius, there is myth about Senegal. And unless you really, really understand these countries, you're going to have a narrative that fits your own ideology or what you think. So I think it's important that he has actually told us what has happened in Senegal. Because it's strange. Senegal is a country in Africa that we respected for its deep civil society. A society that we thought something like this could never happen. But it has happened. And when people talk about whether Wad would run or not, I ask the question, which has not been asked. Yes, he amended the constitution, but was the interpretation right by the constitutional court? I think that question needs to be asked. Second is, the youth, just like the young lady mentioned, cannot see the opposition or have not seen as alternative because there is all of them running are of the same stock, what the professor has said. So really, A, B, or C, you are likely to have the same outcome. So it leads me to the discussion about the system and the costs that are involved, the entry costs into politics, so that the younger generation do not have as much access to political power as those who are older because of the resource costs.
Great, thanks. Well, I think we're almost out of time, so let me give some final comments, and maybe you can respond to the questions about the role of the youth and regional integration and regional organizations and other issues in another minute or two that we have left. Why don't I start with you, Prof?
I think about the role of the youth. What we are getting is what I have always expected. They are mobilized. They are reacting. But one of the most simple facts of registering, in many cases, they are not doing it. And you have ups and down. I was in Dakar June 23rd. I was there for 1 week. And I have seen what has happened, which was completely not prepared. A day before, the opposition was organizing a press conference, and it was disbanded by the youth. They came in, I was there, and they told all of them, enough. You stop talking, you get out. Tomorrow, we are going to demonstrate, you better come. But the youth is always missing one thing. The leaders of political parties are accountable to their party, and they have their own strategy, which is not necessarily the same strategy than the youth. And parties will never expose their leadership, knowing that WADS police will charge them, which has already happened many times. So, and you have this tension between, you know, these leaders being accused of being cowards and, you know, them trying to work their differences and trying to make sure that they are going to win. It's why you have this kind of fragmentation. And the fragmentation is not bad, because I think in Africa, one thing we need really to learn is to respect pluralism and difference. I think this is more important than democracy, you know, because it will help people be tolerant and be able to talk, exchange, and decide on common, to have open societies. The problem we have today is that we have these very close and authoritarian societies. We are always accusing our leaders and leadership, but the society also has to be dealt with. And this is what Senegal, I think, is teaching. Okay. This kind of very, very complicated tensions. Today, I think that what we have been experiencing shows clearly that this country is really very close to a social explosion. And, you know, AKA whatever are around and have been around. You know, Guinea is not very far. Casamance is part of Senegal. But you have the crisis also in Mauritania, et cetera, et cetera. So what does it mean? It means that at a point, if Senegalese are not able to deal with their problem, and today the problem, we like it or not, is an 85 years old man who's just competing with Senghor. He wants to be president at least for 19 years, close to what Senghor have been president. He wants to be more important than Senghor, etc., etc. You know, he's a kind of messiah mentality. You know, and this is the problem. The problem is, what do you do?
Right. Chris?
Yeah, let me pick up on something Vera said right at the beginning of our conversation about how elections test systems. And responding to the question about youth violence around elections, I think that's one indication of the lack of confidence that young people have in governing institutions, whether it's in Senegal or in other countries. And because they can't seek redress, they can't find political space within the framework of institutions that exist, there's this temptation to then act out their frustrations. We had a situation in Ghana in 2008 where we had a very close election. And at one point in that process, the ruling party in Ghana felt aggrieved because the Election Commission had decided to postpone the announcement of the former results until this village up in the northern part of Ghana voted. The ruling party went to court because in Ghana, people believed that they could seek redress from the judiciary. They had confidence in their courts. They went to court. They lost the case. The Election Commission was allowed to maintain its own timeline, and nobody took to the streets, and nobody was killed in the process. So I think whenever we see the youth coming out to manifest their disapproval of the system, it's the symptom of larger issues that our countries ought to be dealing with and should try to deal with if we really think or hope to consolidate democratic governance in our respective countries. On Stite's point, Steve's point, I would say that, first on the light note, I think, let me start with the more serious note on ECOWAS. I think it's a great regional body. ECOWAS, as I said in my remarks, is trying very hard to have some standards. Notably, a few months ago, there was a presidential elections in the Gambia. And the Gambia is a member state of ECOWAS. But ECOWAS made a public decision not to send observers to the Gambia because they said that the environment didn't allow for credible elections. Unfortunately, the African Union, which traditionally ought to defer to the regional bodies, sent a delegation to the Gambia that was chaired by the election commissioner, the chairman of the election commission from Cameroon, who had just run a poor election in his own country, and he went to the Gambia and on behalf of the African Union said that the Gambian elections went very well. At the time when the regional body was trying to hold the line on some standards. So I think that anything that can be done to strengthen some of the regional organizations, especially ECOWAS, would be a worthwhile investment. On the lighter note, we were joking before coming into the panel about how maybe Mo Ibrahim needs to increase the incentive with his prize. Talking about succession, maybe he needs to increase the envelope. But invariably, something needs to be done to remind African heads of states that it's life after the state house, that you can become a world citizen, you can become acknowledged and accomplished and recognized around the world if you govern well and you provide an opportunity for citizens in your country to renew the political leadership of the country.
Farah, let me give you the last word here and ask you just to make a brief summary of what you've heard.
Thank you very much. I think maybe just to answer, because it was a pretty specific question also, and then the remittances and should the diaspora pay taxes. I think in some sense the diaspora is already contributing a lot on the social side in Senegal and in many other countries by remitting the resources that go for education and health because the state cannot provide it. In many of our countries in sub-Saharan Africa, tax collection is a big issue. And I think that asking that question, we could be slightly a little bit ahead of the curve, because first we need to reform the tax incentives in most countries and then bring on the diaspora. Because if the problem is, if you ask the diaspora to pay taxes but we cannot control it, then it will go into a leaking hole. So I think first of all, and a lot of countries are doing better, including Senegal, by the way, in improving the revenue administration. And I think Senegal is about to review its whole tax incentive flow. And I think in that context, one can then look at should they pay taxes and then should they have what do you do with remittances? So that was, I think, a very specific question. Now, I think we've sort of heard a lot about Senegal and almost left here depressed, because we all sort of have a positive feel for Senegal and this is depressing. But I want to say Senegal has had 9 elections. Ghana has had 7, and I think one of the reasons why Senegal has not had a coup d'etat, so there is a history around Senegal which endears us to it, I think. There is a history of debate, there's a history of openness to it, and precisely I think the reason that we're talking about it today with interest is because we're afraid that history is going to change. But again, going back to this question about what can the international community do, and Chris alluded to it earlier, is we've done well so far. At least we can almost congratulate ourselves coming out of the crisis as international partners that Sub-Saharan Africa did well. We're one of the first continents that came out of the crisis growing again with Latin America. So almost sort of the macroeconomic conditions have been attained in most of these countries. So the fight of the 80s on the macroeconomic front is relatively won. Now the second fight is the fight on institutions. One of those fights on institutions is the fight about voice and access to development. And that goes through elections. That goes through electoral process. In many of these countries that we're talking about, we have election committees, we have constitutional courts. Those institutions have been set. Those institutions are being tested, and they're all failing. So just like we all failed in the 80s with our deficits and our debt and sort of went into HIPC and debt forgiveness, I think that is a little bit an analogy that we could look at where Africa is today. Then the question becomes, should we be talking about this 2 weeks to the election, or should we be talking about it 2 years to the election? If we all know that 7 years from today, Cameroon is going to have an election, and 5 years from today, do we have an electoral process in place that works? Do we have the electoral machines in place that work? Are they just distributing the electoral ballots 2 days at a time so we know it's going to be 53%? My sense is I think that progress in testing those institutions will be when we can actually say 2 years before, we have electoral ballots, we have votes that are working, the Electoral Commission, because complaining today about the head of the Constitutional Court or the Electoral Commission is too late. We should have complained about it 2 years ago. We should have complained about it. Institutions like ours, like the one I represent, at least, cannot work directly with the politics. But we're working very hard, I think, with civil society and with the youth to empower them, to give them the information, to give them the best practice of how that can work. And we don't need to go very far to see how it works. You just gave the case of Ghana. Ghana has run and run good elections. Ghana has run close elections without riots. So we know that we can do it. The question is, how do we work now to put in place those institutions that we now know work? There's no African exceptionalism to, I think, elections and to voice. So I'm worried about, you know, let's go back to our old institutions and look at how we work. No. What we need is a transparent process whereby everybody has access to decision-making at that level. And setting up those institutions, I think, is the lesson that we take from here is we need to do it earlier. We need to do it way back when. We need to do it at the beginning of the constitutional process, not, you know, we change. I think one of the questions we should be asking is how many constitutions are changed 2 or 3 years to elections? Because my sense is when the constitution is successfully changed, the election is won.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, let me thank all of you for coming.